Money hasn't always been coins and banknotes. It may have originated as far back as 100,000 years ago as red ochre. But why did money originate? Where do coins come from? And who printed the first money? In this week's Please Explain, Douglas Mudd joins us to discuss the history of money. He is the curator of the American Numismatic Association's Money Museum and the author of All the Money in the World. It's my great pleasure to welcome him to this Please Explain segment. Hi.
Hi, Leonard. How are you?
I'm okay. What is numismatics?
Well, numismatics is the study of money and related items. So it's coins, it's paper money, it's anything that was used as money. And as a sort of a side adjunct area, there's also metals and decorations because of their relationship to the production of coinage.
Well, since money is more than coins and banknotes, how would you define it?
Well, money is anything that people use as a measure of value. So it's something that can be used in exchange or used to measure the relative value of objects. So in the ancient world, you know, cows, for example, were a standard of value, but it can be difficult to use them to value everything because you can't make change out of a cow.
Mm-hmm.
Things like this.
Now, does the word money itself have ancient roots?
Yes. Well, various types, various forms of money, words used for money do. Money itself goes back to the ancient Greek and Latin roots. Numi, for numismatics, for example, is a originally a Greek term. Money itself, it depends on the different usages of it.
It's been theorized that money originated at least 100,000 years ago in Swaziland. What were they using it for?
It would have been used as a ceremonial representation of value. In some cases, it may have actually been used in trade for other things that were necessary. The earliest forms of money were not clear-cut in the sense that we think of a dollar bill as being used to buy something or to be used as a value for something. Early money also had a ceremonial aspect to it. So this explains things like yap money, you know, which is a form of stone money that had value because it was actually mined from a different island. So you'd had to cross about 100 miles of ocean in an open canoe.
And that gave it value.
That gave it value. The size of the money, though, gave it its value as well. And the largest yap stone money that we know of is 13 feet across.
Wow.
So this is not used for daily transactions. You can't carry it in your pocket. And this is where the ceremonial aspect came in, that the size was an aspect of the value, but not in the sense of being able to buy more blankets. It's more of the prestige of the owner.
So money doesn't just have economic reasons for itself.
Exactly.
And my guest on Please Explain today is Douglas Mudd, and this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Now, is money connected to the development of barter systems?
Yes, absolutely. Money develops out of barter systems, and it does so because it becomes very clear early on, okay, a simple barter system is I am a farmer and I produce wheat. My next door neighbor produces pots. And as long as I need a pot and he's willing to trade wheat for it, we're okay. I can trade a certain amount of wheat for a certain amount of pots and we come up with an agreement. But what happens when it starts to get a little bit more complicated, when you have somebody else who has an axe? I don't need an axe, but the person who's producing the axes needs wheat, and the pot person could use the axe. Then you start getting more complicated trades. At some point, it gets to be too complicated, and somebody comes up with the idea, well, why don't we say that this amount of wheat represents one pot, and we'll start trading based on pots, but that's not exactly usable because of certain problems with divisibility. I mean, what's half a pot? You break the pot in half?
So they had to develop symbolic forms for trade.
Yes. So then you get into the whole definition of what is money and what makes useful money. And, you know, there's certain rules. Basically, it has to be relatively scarce. I mean, if you want to use rocks, everybody can get rocks in most places. So the rocks are going to be too common to be used as a regular form of money because, you know, my sheep, I had to take care of, I had to make it, you know, grow it, feed it, all this stuff. It doesn't seem right if somebody just picks up a few rocks and gives them to me. You know, what's the value there? Or
so if you live inland, then shells may be a lot more valuable to you than they would be to somebody who lives on the shore.
Absolutely. That goes to the one of the first forms of money that we see widespread in many different parts of the world are the cowrie shells. And cowrie shells met the criteria for money because, A, they were relatively scarce. They're difficult to copy. You know, you can't. It's not like a piece of paper where you put a check mark on it and that's money. No, this is something that would take some work to copy, and you'd be able to tell if somebody tried to fake a shell. I don't think there's any way to do it exactly. And they're portable, so you know it's not like a car or a house or something where it'd be difficult to move them around and trade them. You can actually carry them in large amounts in small bags and pockets, things like that.
And did money evolve independently all over the world?
It did. It depended on the needs and sophistication of the economies of different cultures, but it did develop all over the world. When we talk about money as we know it, based on metallic coins, there were three major locales where money first appeared, and they appeared roughly around the same period, within a 500-year time span, and that's China, India, and the Middle East.
And they all came up with metal-based money?
Yes. And metal was a choice that worked out very well because what we're talking about here is metal as in bronze, you know, copper-based metal, or silver or gold. And in all three instances, they are metals that are relatively easy, technologically speaking, to handle. Humans figured out how to melt and shape these metals fairly early on. They're relatively easy to find. Gold, for example, you can pan in rivers. Silver is relatively easy to find as well. Copper, the same thing. And so because they're small, they can be made into different size lumps, and in particularly with gold and silver, they're pretty and they last a long time.
But people have to agree on a perceived value. For example, the Aztecs didn't value gold very much. Other cultures have considered it the highest standard. I guess diamonds would have been the only thing that would have superseded gold.
Correct. And diamonds, other than in South Africa, were very rare and very difficult to find, so they wouldn't be
There weren't enough of
suitable.
Them. Mm-hmm. But why gold? But gold not for the Aztecs, and gold, yes, for the Spaniards.
Sure. It's a cultural difference. For the Aztecs, they used different forms of money. In the New World, they didn't really develop money to the degree that was done in the Old World, but the Aztecs did have certain forms that were used as money, for example, the cacao bean. And so they would use cacao beans and certain feathers as a system to value other objects.
And they also put a lot of value on jade. So
as well.
Then we come to the whole matter of standardization. So how was standardization arrived at? Was it always the same size or the same weight, or was there just some kind of a general agreement among people in a certain culture?
Well, one of the critical developments is standardization, but that depended on the level of development of the society. So really, to have money appear in the form of coins, you had to have a system that included primitive banks, some sort of central system that would allow for development of weight standards. So everybody had to accept that, you know, a pound was a pound, and here is a rock or a statue that weighs a pound, and then here are the divisions within that. That creates a standardization which allows people to say, oh, well, this lump of gold is a certain weight, and half of it is this weight, and they're standardized, therefore we can put a value on them and use them as coins.
Were the Greeks the first to invent mass coin production?
They were the first to use coins in mass, yes.
And they also have an aesthetic side to them. Was that an important factor? Because they put images on their coins.
Sure. At first, the primary reason for placing an image on the coins was to identify the person or authority that issued the coins. The reason being that they're the guarantor. They're the people that, if you have a problem, if this coin is light, you could go to and say, hey, this is light, and they would guarantee the coins. Of course, very quickly, that aspect was superseded. I mean, it's still an important part of it, but people began to realize, oh, well, we can put images that represent something. They represent the dynasty, the city itself, values that the city may have or the culture might have.
Did the Romans use coinage differently than the Greeks?
They developed what the Greeks had started and went beyond what they had done to start using coins as a form of propaganda. This is a time before radio, before TV, before newspapers, and by the fact that coins are mass-produced and they had messages on them, the Romans realized that they could use these to pass on information to their citizens and beyond the Roman Empire, and these messages would support the regime, you know, tell stories about the victories of the emperors, things like this.
And so what happened after the fall of the Roman Empire? Did that all fall apart?
It did to an extent. Coins never completely disappeared, but the Germanic tribesmen that took over the Western Roman Empire really had very little need for coinage. Their social system was based on a tribal system with chiefs and the distribution of wealth based on the leaders of the tribe, and the use of coinage wasn't really necessary. Coins, however, did survive as prestige items, so that a powerful warlord or chief would distribute coins, gold coins made on the model of the Roman coinage, as gifts, as marks of favor, things like this. There was also an aspect of tribute. The Byzantine Empire, which was the East Roman Empire, would pay tribute in the form of coinage, so coins did get back into the former Western area.
My guest is Douglas Mudd, curator of the American Numismatic Association's Money Museum and author of All the Money in the World, The Art and History of Paper Money and Coins from Antiquity to the 21st Century. It's published by Collins Books. We will continue our conversation, take your calls at 212-433-9692, and talk about paper money, how that came about.
Grab that cash with both hands and make- a stash.
I'm talking with Douglas Mudd, the curator of the American Numismatic Association's Money Museum and author of a book called All the Money in the World, The Art and History of Paper Money and Coins from Antiquity to the 21st Century, published by Collins Books as part of their Smithsonian series. And you can put your 2 cents in if you want to by giving us a call at 212-433-9692. So far, all the coins are really worth the value of the metal or whatever they're made out of to the people in each culture. When did representative money come along?
Well, it didn't become common until fairly recently, but representative or fiduciary money, which means that the value of the money is determined by the government, it's worth however much it's worth because they say so, actually appeared as early as the 4th century BC, because previously gold and silver were the preferred metals for coinage, but even silver was worth so much that for daily transactions you'd have to have a tiny little coin about the size of the head of a Bic pen, very small coins, and so it became clear that they needed some other metal. At some point in Sicily, the Greeks there came up with the idea of using bronze, and they used it by weight, so it was still the value of the metal. But soon after that, they started using representative coins in bronze, and because of that, they had to put the first denominations on coins that had ever appeared, and they did that in the form of dots. Well, you move forward in time, fiduciary money disappears until essentially the 18th century, when certain countries begin producing low-value coinage again in the form of copper pennies or copper low-value coins. The coinage today, as we know it, is essentially all fiduciary money, and that occurred in the 1930s, basically because of the Great Depression and the collapse of the gold system for backing of money.
Although I've heard that pennies cost more than a penny to produce, so it can work both ways.
Yeah, that's an ongoing problem as the value of metals, copper in particular, goes up. It creates an issue where if it costs too much to produce the money, what do you do about it?
Now, what about paper money? Who came up with that idea?
Well, the Chinese first invented paper money in the 9th century AD, and they used it for about six centuries, before abandoning it. It originally came about for the Chinese because of a severe shortage of copper to produce their basic coinage, and somebody came up with a brilliant idea of producing money made out of paper that would represent the copper. The problem is they made too much of this money and went through a lot of serious problems with inflation and the collapse of the monetary system.
Now the paper money was really symbolic of some other money, some metal that was kept somewhere, wasn't it? And as we later had all that gold in Fort Knox that was supposed to add up to the same amount of money that was out there in dollar bills?
Absolutely. And this is how the Europeans began using paper money in the 1660s. It was always at first used to represent real money, because real money is silver and gold.
So a pound sterling means that piece of paper was worth a pound of sterling silver?
The notional pound, not an actual pound of sterling silver, but the coin, the actual coin. So that continued on for a long while. But today, as we all know, most people don't even think about their paper money, even though it's not backed by any silver or gold or something that in the past was considered to be the only real money.
Well, let's take a call from Philip. By the way, our number here is 212-433-9692. Philip from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah, I was just wondering why America, you know, like why did we go off the gold standard for money, and what happened to all that gold?
Yeah, well, there was all that gold at Fort Knox. Is it still there?
Yeah, we still have gold at Fort Knox, and it still forms a part of the. It's not backing our money directly as it used to, but it is forming part of our reserves. The idea of maintaining confidence in U.S. money because we have a huge reserve of gold at Fort Knox for emergencies.
When did we stop having a dollar for dollar equality in that regard?
Well, we stopped issuing gold as coinage in the 1930s. In 1933, we stopped issuing gold coins, but the dollar was still backed by gold until 1971.
So it's that recent?
Yes.
It's interesting that in Europe, where with the introduction of the euro, we're seeing a return to coins on the lower denominations rather than paper bills for 1 euro and the like.
Sure, and that's an economic decision as much as anything else. Essentially, it turns out that dollar bills or 1 euro bills or whatever the basic standard unit is circulate quite a bit because it's something that's used in everyday transactions, and they don't last very long. So the average dollar bill only lasts something like 18 months in circulation. It turns out that a dollar coin actually lasts about 30 years. The dollar coin costs about four times as much to produce, but you can see that there would be a savings in the long term by using the dollar coins. So that's the idea behind why this conversion's been going on in many places in the world.
When the switch was made to paper money, wasn't counterfeiting a problem from the start?
Absolutely. Yeah, counterfeiting was a major problem because, paper is very inexpensive, and the ability to print on that paper is not a high technology item. So from the very earliest times when they started producing paper, there was always this battle between the people producing paper and the security measures they would add and the counterfeiters and what they could do to replicate those measures.
Why didn't the switch from the gold standard lead to inflation?
That's a very complicated question.
The money does not collapse in value, although I've never understood why a dollar fluctuate in relation to the Canadian dollar or the British pound or the euro. But in the end, when I hand somebody that piece of paper, which is not backed by gold anymore, we could be going through the same sort of thing that the Germans went through in the Weimar Republic between the wars, couldn't we?
Yes, theoretically. The difference is based on several factors. One of them is we know better than we did back then. The other, so supposedly we should be able to avoid some of the same problems. Another factor is that the Federal Reserve very closely controls how much money we produce based on the demand for money, and they have a very complicated system for determining that. So that the reason why inflation occurs with regards to paper money is if there's too much money being produced and there's too much money available, which translates into loans are too easy to get, the interest rate is too low, things like this, then there's too much money, and that encourages inflation. It gets down to a very basic level. If I produce a certain commodity and I see that everybody's making more money, I'll be I'll feel pretty silly if I'm selling it for the same price and everybody's salary has gone up or they've got more money available. Why don't I raise the price of the item to meet expectations, essentially?
Let's take a call from James from Brooklyn. You have a question along these lines, don't you, James?
Expectations, essentially.
James, you have to turn down your radio. James, you didn't come to the phone. I'm sorry about that. So let's go to Flynn, also from Brooklyn. Hi, Flynn.
Hi. I actually did have a similar question on the interest rates and cash flow and Federal Reserve Bank. But I also wanted to bring up the point that isn't there a new currency being introduced between Mexico, America, and Canada called the Amero? And I also really want to know about the Federal Reserve Bank, because it's not a real federal department, but it's a private bank, and nobody knows this. This is not a clear point made to the general public. And if that's the case, then they are controlling the interest rates and the cash flow. How do they make that determination, and why should they have that power?
Well, you're getting into a lot of things. The Amero is not an official issue, and there's lots of rumors and information going around that it's not very clear what's going on with that. The Amero is not a government project by the Canadians, by the Mexicans, or by the United States. When it comes to the Federal Reserve Banks, they're not fully a private institution. They are a semi-private governmental institution. They're not fully a part of the government, but they are. They essentially operate almost as in other countries a central national bank does. It's sort of the American compromise from back in the early days of the Republic, when Andrew Jackson got rid of the Bank of the United States, which was an attempt to create a national central bank. The Federal Reserve was designed to create a central entity that could help stabilize the economy of the country by controlling the amount of money in circulation.
We thank you for your call, Flynn. There were predictions some years back that all money in the future would be plastic. We haven't seen that happen, but can we call credit cards money?
They definitely take on a lot of the elements of money. I would say that they are money. They represent money, and they hold value. They represent the value of money that's located someplace else, but essentially they do act as money.
What about e-money?
The same goes for e-money. It's not a physical entity anymore, but then most transactions, monetary transactions, are not handled in a physical form anymore, especially at the larger levels.
Why we no longer have bills for huge denominations like Woodrow Wilson on the $100,000 bill?
Yes, that is a major reason for it. In part, it also has to do with other aspects such as the ability to control operations of, well, basically to control crime, for example, the transfer of huge amounts of money for drugs and other things was part of the rationale behind that. So the $100 bill was determined to be a reasonable denomination for use in most transactions, and anything larger than that could be handled electronically, which can also be controlled more easily.
Now, a number of people have called in with personal questions about the value of gold coins or other things that date back to the 30s and even earlier. How do they find out about those things?
How do you mean? How do they find out?
I mean, are there places where they can actually bring them and find the value of these collector's items?
Yes. There are places online on the web, places like coinfacts.com and our own website, the ANA at money.org. Money.org is our website. You can ask questions and find out information about the value of coins. You can also take them to your local coin dealers, the hobby shops that deal in coins. There are catalogs available as well. For U.S. coins, the most commonly used is one that's known as the Red Book.
And we have to leave it there. I want to thank you so much, Douglas Mudd, curator of the American Numismatic Association's Money Museum and author of All the Money in the World from Collins Books. Thank you so much for being on today's Please Explain.
Thank you, Leonard.
On Monday's show, guest host Lisa Bernbeck talks with a sociologist who joined a gang in order to study it. Also, a woman who suddenly discovered she needed a heart transplant when she was only 24 years old, plus efforts to save the Indian rhino, and an abortion doctor talks about the challenges of her job. By the way, have you seen our guest picks feature on our show page at WNYC.org? You can go there to find out surprising facts about some of our guests. Madeline Albright recently told us she's an ice hockey fan. The Leonard LoPage Show is produced by Sarah English, Scott Goldberg, and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from John Cottrell, Jacob Stevens, and Fran Jacobs. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard LoPage, your host. Have a great weekend.